I'm going to have a fascinating discussion with theologian and apologist John Rankin about the kingdom of God and politics.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to The Line of Fire. My guest, John Rankin, is going to join us in a few minutes, actually says, get this, that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are not radical enough. Did you hear that? Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are not radical enough. What in the world is he talking about? And how do we get a Christian perspective on politics? I mean, isn't everybody dirty or corrupt or lying or mixed or wrong motivation or sold out? Or we'll talk about it. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call if you want to weigh in. 866-348-7884. All right, a couple of important updates first. I wrote an article that was posted yesterday. No, Theodore Schubert, Jesus would not have killed gays. If you want to see what I wrote in the article, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and click on latest articles. You can read it for yourself. I also said, this was in the course of 2 hours of broadcasting yesterday, that I had really distanced myself from positions that Waleed Shubat, who I've had on the air before, and his son Theodore have taken. Well, we were in contact yesterday and spoke for maybe a half hour to 45 minutes on the phone, and it was a very constructive conversation. That was with Waleed and with Theodore, and I hope to continue the conversation and also to debate some of the relevant issues with Theodore. But pray for God's best for Waleed and Theodore and for me as we interact. I just want to give that public update as I'd said things publicly on the air yesterday and posted my article. Of course, as to what I wrote in the article, the content of my position of 100% unchanged to the letter. However, in my dialogue with Waleed and Theodore, we've had some very constructive conversations, so thank God for that. Also, I spoke this morning at a chapel service. Grades 6 through 12, I believe. I spoke at a chapel service in Charlotte, North Carolina this morning. And several hundred kids, they seemed to really worship. They were totally respectful as I spoke. There was not a cell phone out or anything like that. They took notes during my message and as I shared my testimony. And I got to interact with a few of them afterwards, some very kind words from a few, and interacted with one gentleman that just wanted to share some things going on in his life. And I want to share with you what I shared with them. I was talking about the seductiveness of sin. And, you know, sin is there to catch us and ensnare us, whether we're 10 or 50 or 90. As long as we're still breathing, sin is there to try to attack and ensnare. And I told one person that we were talking about someone struggling with substance abuse. And I said, you know, drugs are stronger than that person is, but Jesus is stronger than those drugs. And I told the students this. I never planned on shooting heroin when I was 15 years old. The girl who's got a sexually transmitted disease at 14, she never planned on that. The guy that's in prison for life at the age of 19, he never planned on that. And there's an old saying about sin. It will take you further than you plan to go. It will cost you more than you plan to pay. It'll keep you longer than you planned to stay. And as I said to the students today, sin will never satisfy. If I could just do this, if I could just kiss her, if I could just go to this website, if I just have that drink, if I could just have this, I'd be satisfied. No, sin doesn't satisfy. Instead, it creates an appetite for more sins. Sin leads to more sins, and then those sins don't excite anymore. And they don't satisfy anymore, so sin leads to worse sins, and before you know it, you're enslaved. Jesus said, if the Son sets you free indeed. Don't play games with your freedom. Maybe this is a timely word for one of you here. Maybe Jesus has really delivered you. Don't play games. Don't go back. Forward only. And if you're bound in sin, Jesus can set you free just like he set me free. We'll be right back with John Rankin.
Yeah.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to the Line of Fire. If you've got a question for my guest or for me, the number to call 866-348-7884. It's Wednesday. We often focus on worldview issues. I lost my word there. On Wednesday, I'm speaking with Reverend John Rankin. He's president of the Theological Education Institute. He's been on the air with us before. He's an author, an apologist, a theologian. He is working on an MPhil and PhD in political theology at the Oxford Center for Mission Studies. And he's done a class for us at our School of Ministry years back. And what I love about John is his Christian perspective always challenges us. The nickname, or excuse me, the byword for his Theological Education Institute, that's TEII.org, is the power to love hard questions. John, welcome back to the Line of Fire.
Michael, it's a joy to be here, but I actually don't think I've been welcomed back. I think this is my first time.
All right. I differ, but we'll check.
That's because you have a better memory than I do.
Could be. I mean, I tend to remember what shows I was on, but I get welcomed back and I forget too. So let me put out something first before we get into any specific discussion or your blog about neither Bernie Sanders nor Donald Trump or not, they're not radical enough. That's going to open some eyes. But is there a difference between patriotism and the kingdom of God that often gets blurred in American Christianity?
Oh, very easily. And the difficulty is this. And in fact, you mentioned the PhD work I'm doing in Oxford right now, which back into academia after 30 years when I did my prior work at Harvard in ethics and public policy. And that was in I was in a minority opinion as an evangelical in that world, and I learned a lot. Now I'm at an evangelical institution, and my thesis is on Hebrew covenant, human freedom, and the U.S. Constitution, looking at the great Jewish scholar Daniel Elazar. And what Elazar does is he argues for a straight line between the Hebrew covenant and the U.S. Constitution. And historically, you can't make it a straight line because there's a lot of detours in church history. But there's an intrinsic line. There's no other source for our freedom and for sound law other than introduced in the biblical order of creation. And so this comes back to your question about patriotism. We are so blessed because of the biblical ethics upon which this nation were founded. And as I like to say, we weren't founded as a Christian nation. We were a nation founded by Christians for all people equally. And this traces back to the nature of Genesis and the nature of who Jesus is. And so whenever religious, political, and economic liberty are advanced, the gospel flourishes. And then only the gospel can produce those freedoms. So what I'm always seeking to do is to honor those freedoms in all people equally as image bearers of God, and particularly within the Muslim world, where it could be very tough because they don't have a theological foundation to understand that. But they're wired as image bearers of God to that freedom. So whatever the context is, you honor that freedom in people, and once they identify with that freedom, they become more open to the gospel itself, Jesus fulfilling what was given to us in Genesis 1 and 2. Jesus as the second Adam fulfilling what the first Adam didn't fulfill. So back to your question about patriotism. Since we are so blessed by the biblical input on this nation, it's easy to conflate the two and to think that this nation is a chosen nation. No, the ancient Israelites, the Hebrews, were a chosen nation to lead us to the Christ. Now all people are chosen. You don't have one nation chosen over another nation. But by the same token, we are one nation who chose to honor biblical ethics in a dynamically, historically unique way. And so that's why we have the blessings, though we're losing those blessings rapidly at this point. So what happens is that our patriotism, if it overtakes the gospel, it becomes an idol. Now, I did pro-life ministry for very many years, and I saw very early on, back in 1983, the many good-minded Christians, be they Catholic or Protestant, who were in the pro-life movement, could actually make pro-life more important than the gospel. So pro-life is good, but if the good is put ahead of God, it becomes an idol. And so our nation has so many blessings, But if the memory of our nation or the present reality of our nation is put ahead of the gospel under the name of patriotism, quote-unquote, then it becomes an idol. So what I'm always saying is my identity, first of all, is biblical. And on that basis, I will be the best citizen possible for the well-being of the nation.
Got it. So similar to the Jeremiah 29 mentality of the Judean exiles in Babylon, that they were to pray for the city, pray for the prosperity of the nation where they were, as it prospered, they would prosper. So they were citizens in a foreign land, but even though it was not their homeland, they were to be good citizens and they were to live ethical lives. All the more we should do that. What I often find uncomfortable, especially during the political season, is we have such a strong nationalism. And let's say, at least on the Republican side, USA, USA, God and guns, and a lot of things kind of get mixed together. Whereas, yes, I want God to bless America versus curse America, but my prayer is always, Lord, your kingdom come to America. Because God bless America normally means make us bigger and better and stronger and prosper our economy and build up our military, whereas your kingdom come to America means God change us so that we can be people that you can bless.
Absolutely, and I think that we're coming to a watershed moment in U.S. history right now. I think that the biblical foundations of our country have either been misunderstood or misappropriated to such a point now that they're publicly mocked. And so we come to a place where someone like Donald Trump can be voted on by many evangelicals that have nothing to do with the substance of the man. They just want a reaction to a reaction of Obama. And the problem, and I point this out in my blog and my YouTubes on Trump and Sanders are not radical enough, is that when you're a radical, you go to the root level, which is Genesis 1 and 2 ultimately. When you're a reactionary, you never control your life nor the terms of the debate. You react to a prior reactionary, which reacts to a prior reaction, all the way back to the original reactions of in the Garden of Eden. And the more we do that, the more we drown in the same miserable soup. And therefore, a true biblical radical is never going to go according to current political thinking or ego manipulations. And so when you see any candidate, and many of whom claim to be Christian, and yet they can fall so readily into ego versus ego, or willing to be reactive in their identities. I think it breaks the heart of the gospel when they do that.
Yeah, and of course, then we get caught up in a partisan way as well. It's very difficult, and I don't envy any Christian politician, because when you have attack ads being aired against you, and you don't respond, obviously you could say, well, God will fight for us, but the normal way to respond is with an attack ad in kind, and it becomes very difficult. I mean, you can always get the truth out, but the spirit of it, very, very difficult to conduct yourself the way you would outside of politics, within politics. All right, we've got two minutes.
You know, I think it becomes a sullied truth, and therefore it's not true. So for example, one of my most fun clips is that I like to ask people, and I'll ask you and test your knowledge of physics, but what is the speed of darkness?
Don't know that.
It doesn't exist.
Okay.
It has no atomic weight. Therefore, wherever light is present, by definition, the darkness eviscerates. How well do we know that in terms of the power of the proactive? And I write considerably on this, and this is how Jesus faced his enemies during Passover week. And so listeners could go to one of my web pages. They all go back to my TEII.org website, but go to prepartisan.org, and you'll see how I go deeper than the partisan for what I think is a proactive, positive contribution, which if we, the church, got a sense of that vision, we could turn this nation around quite readily.
Got it. Yeah, and we're gonna unpack that. Again, the website, TEII.org. Got a minute and a half before the break. People often say when I raise moral issues of integrity, well, we're not electing a pastor, we're electing a president. Do we need a president with moral integrity to guide the nation in the right direction overall?
We do. And then at the deeper question, we don't need a pastor, we need a president, I think is a false conflict. What is a pastor? Okay, a pastor is someone who puts his best energies on behalf of others within the structure of the church. So it's not that we need a pastor in the president's office, but we need someone with pastoral sensibilities, someone who as Jesus looked over Jerusalem and wept, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. It has to be that type of character who puts other people first. And so it would be lovely to see someone who's got the pastoral instincts, but also the political skills, the honest political skills to lead the nation.
Got it. All right, friends, we're going to continue a conversation with John Rankin and get specific. I want to ask about socialism and the gospel. I want to ask what issues should be the most important to us from a Christian perspective. South Carolina primary, some of you are listening in South Carolina. We're going to talk about that, how to sort that out. Go to John's website. He's got great books there, YouTube videos, and blogs as well. TEII, Theological Education Institute. Go there, TEII.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. I was wrong and right about John being on with us previously. John didn't remember being on The Line of Fire previously. So, John, I was wrong and I was right. I was wrong in that I can't find in our archives when I had you on as a guest. However, have I heard your voice on the show? Yes, because at different times we have offered your Only Genesis lectures that you did for us. And we would play clips and I would hear your voice. But I still, who was it that I taught? I remember having a problem with a phone line one time and I thought we were on with you. But anyway, we'll get to the bottom of it. All right, so John, again, the website, TEII.org, Theological Education Institute.org. And,
let me just say, it's TEI International. That's why there's two I's.
Yep, yep.
There was no way I could ever get TEI.org. When I started teaching internationally, all of a sudden I was able to get TEII.org.
Got it. Yeah, and the international was outside of the logo, and I kept thinking,
that's
okay,
right.
what am I missing? I'm looking at the logo, but that's
well,
it.
I didn't have the ability to redo the logo.
No, that works. That works. The power to love hard questions. And by the way, John has debated all kinds of folks in all kinds of settings and is known for not just his Christian commitment and his rigorous intellectualism, but his Christian demeanor, which has won more debates than anything and won people to listen to our side. All right, John, let's say...
if I could just make one word about that, the Marisol Forum series... The goal is to take a truly debated issue to win the relationship, not to win the debate. If you win the relationship, then the debate begins to take care of itself. And so I've done, along with my pro-life debates in the 1980s, I've done some 200-plus of these public conversations. And I would say in all but three cases, the humanity of the person I was doing the forum or debate with actually grew as a result. And if you... watch someone's humanity grow, they become more open to the gospel, and that's my modest goal.
Yeah, and by God's grace, you've been a model of that. All right, let's unpack this. We'll focus on South Carolina for 5-6 minutes, but then I want to continue to talk about socialism, about other things, about a Christian approach to this. And folks, if you miss any part of the interview, just go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Later today, you can listen to the whole hour that we'll be spending together. All right. For me, when I look at a candidate, the first thing I want to see is where this person stands on issues having to do with life, so abortion-related issues, where they stand on issues having to do with family. And for me, where they stand on Israel is important as well. But I look at that first. And then secondly, I ask the question, okay, could they be a good president or elected official in the other areas where they have to serve? Now, that's just my own personal checklist to start in terms of non-negotiables. Should we have any non-negotiables? Should we have lines that we will not cross no matter what? So say in the days of slavery, pro-slave candidate, we're not going to vote for no matter how effective they could be in other ways. Or is that being too narrow-minded?
There are lines not to cross, but there's deeper realities. So, for example, one of my ancestral relatives is the Reverend John Thomas Rankin, and he was known as the manager of the Underground Railroad. In fact, many of Harriet Beecher Stowe's illustrations in Uncle Tom's Cabin came from her friendship with John Rankin. And he left Kentucky in the 1830s to protest it being a slave state and moved across the river to Ohio, where he set up shop, and he and his seven sons escorted at least 2,000 slaves to freedom, and they were networked throughout the entire Underground Railroad. So he drew a line, but he drew a line because of a deeper reality. So to take a different angle here, I used to have a U.S. representative, a member of Congress, who would talk to me about all sorts of stuff but never bring up the issue of abortion. And this congresswoman was Republican, but very much in favor of legalized abortion. And so there was a wall at that point. On the other hand, there was a Democrat here in the state who also was in favor, quote-unquote, of legalized abortion, but he was willing to talk with me. Mm-hmm. And then another representative who held a quote-unquote pro-choice position was willing to talk to me. And after two rounds of talking with him, he said, "You've made the most compelling pro-life presentation I've ever heard." Well, it didn't change his vote because he was surrounded by a political enterprise that didn't give him that wiggle room. But I'm looking for the person who's actually willing to talk in the face of hard questions. And if they are, there's a deeper character element that's involved. So some people can take a pro-life position, but they can take it for political calculations. In fact, I had a U.S. congressman in Massachusetts when I was in a seminary at Gordon Conwell, who was a Democrat, which most of Massachusetts was, and he was pro-life. And so I voted for him only because he was pro-life and the Republican opponent that one given year was not. Well, then this guy got convicted of all sorts of crimes not long thereafter and kicked out of office. So we have to probe deeper to the character. Why do people end up being pro-life or pro-family? What is their understanding of Israel? So, for example, given certain theological debates about the nature of Israel, and I have certain opinions on it, I will say one thing that I think should be easily accessible to all people. They are the only functioning government in the Middle East rooted in checks and balances, and as a result of which, and it goes back to Genesis in my estimation, and they allow the opposition to be heard. They're not perfect, but what happens is because they allow that to happen and because they really do have a thirst for freedom, you can be a part of that society and know that your human rights are protected better than any of your neighbors and are willing to receive a good biblical input. And so I would always judge, from my perspective, where is honest input willing to be received? And on that basis, I may be counterintuitive in choosing between two candidates.
Got it. So even if a candidate was not in the right direction now, if you saw that they were open to move in the right direction, you would think there's the potential of that person being positively influenced in the days to come.
Yes, and so if they were one candidate and the other candidate had the right position but I found them to be insufferably proud or not listening, that could sway my vote, or all other things being equal. But the point is, if we have litmus tests, which is something I don't really care for because they tend to be rules and checklists. And rules and checklists do not serve humanity very well. The whole Bible, and you know this so wonderfully well, as the Hebrew scholar, the whole Bible is a storyline first, out of which we draw the Ten Commandments, or the Sermon on the Mount, or some of the doctrines that the Apostle Paul teaches. And so unless we know the storyline, and God's goodness and his love for us, and the nature of forgiveness, then we are hampered in interpreting judgments we have to make otherwise. And or if we reduce them simply to a checklist in a political context, we can miss the deeper realities.
Got it. Right. I've got it.
All the while saying that I am a pro-life libertarian, which is to say that life, liberty, and property and the power to pursue happiness in John Locke's language and Thomas Jefferson and the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments are the foundations for healthy government, and they all go back to Genesis. God who gives us life, who gives us liberty, and good stewardship of his creation. So that's always the prism through which I view truth.
All right, got to jump in. Go to teii.org, theologicaleducationinstitute.org, to find out more about my guest, John Rankin. We're going to continue to talk another half hour. You can keep listening on your radio stations or at AskDrBrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. I'm speaking about politics, Christian principles, kingdom of God with my guest, John Rankin. You can go to his website, the Theological Education Institute, that is TEII.org. So let's get very specific and practical. In this segment, we've got about 4.5 minutes, so we'll just jump through this. Let's say you're going to vote for a Republican, and you're looking at the current candidates in South Carolina. How does John Rankin sort that out? You live in South Carolina, and you're going to determine who to vote for. How are you going to sort that out? And let's assume you have no ability directly to influence that. You don't know any of these people personally. You can't personally influence them. You're just another voter. How are you going to sort this out?
Well, it goes back to what we just spoke about. I'm aiming to judge the character. Is the character consistent? Does he or she articulate a biblical worldview that is not only spoken of creedalistically, but also do they love their neighbors? Do they love their enemies? Focus on trust versus distrust. So on that basis, I would say that most of the candidates have some real serious liabilities, including some who are professed Christians. I would say that Ben Carson has the least liabilities in this regard. And, you know, I'm disappointed with Jeb Bush in that when he started his campaign over a year ago, he talked about, I want to be positive and I don't want to be dragged down in the mud. And yet Donald Trump found a way to get under his skin and bring him down into the mud quite a while ago. And so it's issues like that. And then you see, the animosity between Cruz and Trump, between Cruz and Rubio vice versa, though. Rubio tends to be more, he doesn't start off in the attack mode. He tends to defend himself. And so that to me is a higher quality. So I've been a little bit specific where I normally am not, but this is the reality of what we're facing right now.
Yep.
So if I were in South Carolina voting right now, I might do a write-in vote for Michael Brown.
Ah, okay. Yeah, somebody asked me the other day, they said if Ted Cruz, because I've endorsed Ted Cruz, they said if Ted Cruz is elected president, do you think he'll have you pray the inaugural prayer first? I'm just one person. I mean, a ton of people have endorsed him, you know. And I've said from the start, my goal is not to bash other candidates or be his apologist, although I've been very critical of Donald Trump, specifically evangelicals supporting Donald Trump. But I said, you know, you don't want somebody as so there'd be 1,000 people on a list he'd have before me. That's my opinion. The second thing is,
I just was going to the top. You know, with Ted Cruz, though, the difficulty at many points, or the way I would judge it, I don't like a lot of what he's done, okay? I like his constitutional expertise. I don't like a lot of how he's conducted himself. So the way I would judge the matter is say, is this a man I could sit down and talk to as a brother in Christ and raise the questions I have? And see, that's the deepest quality that we referred to earlier, a person willing to look at hard biblical questions and be accountable and be humble in the face of them, which I have to be first, otherwise I'm not in position to pose the questions of others.
Yeah, and by the way, I knew that you were going to do the write-in vote for me. My point was that, aside from that, I'd be the wrong guy. Even open in prayer, I said, a divisive character like me, as controversial as me, right? That's the perfect thing to unite the nation on an inaugural prayer day. But, you know, the other thing, though, that is interesting, and I know any politician could potentially say this. And by the way, we come back, I want to talk about socialism. I actually had a caller say, well, if you're Christian, how come you're not supporting Bernie Sanders? So we'll come back to that. And then libertarian issues and where that comes in with the Rand Pauls and Ron Pauls and all that. But what's very interesting is that when I had issues with a couple of things that the Cruz campaign did, I was able to convey those to leaders within the campaign and get a hearing at the highest level. That encouraged me. And when Ted Cruz met with several hundred faith leaders in Texas, he said to everyone, if I'm elected, you must hold me accountable. He said, you are my accountability board. Now, anyone could say that. I just want you to know he did say it.
Fire we want, for fire we please. Stand in the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on The Line of Fire today, 866-34-TRUTH. I'm speaking with John Rankin, who's the founder and president of Theological Education Institute International, TEII.org. Visit his website, check out his books, his articles, blogs, videos. John, socialism, sharing the wealth, doing things the way they're done more in Europe, you go to college and it's state subsidized and things like that. Should that be A, something that we pursue here in America, say with the Bernie Sanders? Let's put aside the other issues where he has some very unbiblical stands. But A, is that something we should pursue here in America? And B, is that more in keeping with a Christian worldview?
Well, you know, the first question you'd have to ask is, why do people think that it is consistent with the Christian worldview? And I just make two observations. The first one is, many people talk about the disciples sharing among themselves after Pentecost in the book of Acts. But the problem is that that was voluntary in an emergency situation, and private property remained private property. And this is why Ananias and Sapphira died, because they lied to the Lord when they said they gave all their private property when they didn't. And then Barnabas, you know, who gave of his wealth to begin with, you know, he did that of his own volition. To take a story like that and make it into an economic philosophy does violence to the scripture, number one. Number two, and maybe I have more than 2 points, if you go back to the law of Moses and the whole Jubilee ethic, forgiveness of sins, returning the land to the original owners and so forth, there's an incredibly wonderful structure that takes care of the poor, honors private property, and keeps private property in the local family unit. Socialism does not have interest in the local family unit. It is a top-down government that rules over everybody else and redistributes the wealth. So what I did in my blog today, in my YouTube, in Trump and Sanders, I am critiquing both of them. And I said at one point, Mr. Trump, are you a prisoner to a thin skin, or can you give a proactive definition of freedom that rises higher? And then for Sanders, I said, Mr. Sanders, are you a prisoner to the fear of private greed, and how does public greed liberate anyone? So if anyone knows the history of Adam Smith and capitalism, Karl Marx's reaction on Forward, they will understand that you can make an idol in either direction. Either you want everything for yourself while you trample others, or you want to have everyone's private property under your own control with you as head of the political pile, which is really what socialism is. So a self-serving capitalism is not good, nor is it socialism. I believe in what I will call the free market economy, and I'll go back to the Bible for that basis. So, and then, of course, you know Margaret Thatcher's famous quip years ago, the problem with socialism is that eventually they run out of other people's money.
Right, exactly.
They're not cultivating the human spirit. They're not setting the spirit free to invest, to risk, to fail and succeed. And that's the whole reality of being a parent to our own children, is to nurse them through that so that by the time they come to adulthood, they can then go out on their own. And we're always going to have failures, but do we do it in community where we learn to succeed? And our success is always and only predicated on helping other people succeed as a result of the work we do.
All right. When you talk about free market economy being biblical, obviously, for you, that's a no-brainer to support that. But flesh that out. Again, we're not talking about a self-serving capitalism, but free market economy. How, in your mind, is that based on biblical principles? Help those that may not see it as clearly as you do.
Well, I don't usually use the word principles because people can atomize them. So I talk about ethics, that which is relational. So we can make two observations here. In, I think it's Leviticus, in the law of Moses, at one point, Yahweh says to the Israelites, this is my land, not yours. Then later he says, take good care of your land. So he's establishing a relationship there. He, just back to Genesis 1 and 2, Yahweh gives to us everything that is good. We're stewards of it. When we're stewards of having received his gift, we take care of it well in order to bless others. But we do have, well, you know, as Micah and other prophets say, every man needs his vine and fig tree shall live in peace and unafraid. That's the biblical dream, you know, that precedes any definition of the American dream. And so all of that, but see, the other element, too, is that we have so much individualism in this country, and some of this you can lay at the feet of John Locke, but we have so much individualism in this nation that we only think of economics in terms of our own personal advance. That's false. The word economics, from oikonomos in the Greek and bayit in the Hebrew, refers to the rule of the household. And so the greatest economic engine there is in history is when a man is faithful to his woman in marriage and faithful to his children. And so, and this is the whole biblical relational power of what is there. The second observation is that Jesus, of his 42, and I did this once, his 42 discrete parables across the Gospels, 41 of them are economic in their nature. Mm. And so, you know, we are free to do with what we're given what we do with it, but we're accountable for it. So a free market economy says you are free to own the fruit of your labor, okay? You're not to steal. This is the Ten Commandments. You're not to defraud. Everyone's private property is protected. But if that property becomes yours, so when, and I did this in one of my blogs vis-a-vis Trump, when Jesus talks about the man who has filled his barns with wheat and he's set for a lifetime and says, you know, I'm all set, and then God says, you fool, this night your soul is required of you.
Yep.
So what happens is, at the simplest level, everything we have is God's gift to us for our blessing. And if we receive it as a gift and want to give what we have to others, in giving you shall receive, that's the biblical basis for free market economy.
Got it. Loud and clear. And again, when you, you know, I'll read the parables, and when I read them, I'm normally thinking in terms of just, okay, how does this apply to my own life, stewardship, and I'm not thinking economically, but you're absolutely right. They are presupposing these very things of which you speak, or which you don't like to call principles. So could you see a Christian voting for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, knowing where they stand on abortion, knowing where they stand on homosexuality, knowing some other issues that would be of concern? I wrote an article, Shame on the Pastors Who Anointed Hillary Clinton to Be President, where they said she's surrounded by the favor of the Lord. They weren't just speaking this by faith. They were speaking this as if it's true. And I said the favor of the Lord is not on a radical pro-abortion candidate and one that enraged African nations with her pushing gay activism. That's my perspective.
Oh, my goodness, yes. And yeah, I have personal experience with that.
Yeah, and look,
with some of my African connections, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to people in leadership or related to leaders who talk about the phone call they got from the White House, from high-level officials putting them under pressure. You do what we want on gay activism or you lose your funding. And not
yeah.
Africa, some other countries. So, again, everyone has to give account to God, not to me, not to you. But from your perspective, could a Christian vote for either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton?
Let me probe a little bit deeper again to the pastoral perspective. I'm going to ask, why do people vote for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders? And we look in the black community and see they vote 90% plus black. There's a whole Democrat. There's a whole history to that, and I won't go into that right now. But what happens is you can become part of groupthink and what you owe to the group you're part of, in genuine love, as well as perhaps fear or political IOUs and that type of stuff. And so that's the level which I would challenge people to think and say, listen, do you believe this woman is biblical in what she believes and how she lives her life, or this man? That's the first question I would ask any believer. But because of people's own situations, what they know, what they don't know, what they hope for, what they fear, and so forth, I can see a Christian making wrong choices in voting. And I don't want to be the one who accuses them. I don't want to be the one who says, no, you're wrong, you can't do that. I'm very, I think my best contribution, and even if I were in partisan politics, it would be the same thing. My best contribution is to build up the image of God among the people who are making those decisions. Now, for the pastors, they're held to a higher standard. So I would sit them down and say, okay, what are your biblical reasons for doing this? And this perhaps is why the motto for the TEI is the power to love hard questions. When we give statements, you know, statements, declarative statements, that's the word I was looking for. When we make declarative statements, it walls off communications, unless it's in a context where we understand why it's declarative, you know, such as it's raining, you're going to get wet. But when it comes to political opinions, to make a declarative statement, people pull back and the conversation, the relationship doesn't happen as well. On the other hand, if you pose a question in which they have interest and you indicate that you're open to conversation wherever it goes, then you serve the image of God and you do far better at helping address an issue like this.
All right, so we come back. I want you to pose questions regarding Donald Trump as a candidate, pose questions for his supporters and detractors, and anything else you'd like to contribute in this election season. In our last segment with John Rankin, go to teii.org.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire, 866-348-7884, as I speak with John Rankin in our last segment. John, I do appreciate you taking the time to join me. Okay, let's say you want to ask questions, the power to love the hard questions. You want to ask honest questions to supporters of Donald Trump to evaluate whether he's the man they want to vote for. And they claim to be Christians. They claim to be evangelicals who love the word and who love the Lord. What questions would you pose to them?
Before I say that, let me ask you this. How many evangelical believers or other people, when they vote for a person, have actually invested thinking time? Or how many of them are just sort of following what they here on the media, it's more emotivistic. I think it's far more the latter. So the biggest challenge we have is to actually find a place for thinking to happen. That's basically been my goal for several decades right now. And I have some initiatives that are on deck in that direction. So I can tell you the questions, but where can these questions actually have their impact? So for Trump, I would ask him, does he have a proactive political philosophy? He doesn't. He's never said so. Does he have an economic philosophy? He's never said so. I think his only economic philosophy is Nickabrick in the Chronicles of Narnia. You know, when he said the dwarves are for the dwarves, they'll participate in the battle for the common good, but when all is said and done, they only care about themselves. And I think that Trump is for Trump in the same way. That's his whole business motif when it comes to building hotels and casinos and eminent domain and things like that. And so that's a question I would ask him. Does he think inside the box or outside the box? Does he even know about the writings of Adam Smith and Karl Marx, Bastiat and von Mises and Keynes and Hayek and Milton Friedman? Does he even understand this world, or is everything just Trump is for Trump? So those would be some of the questions I would ask to see, because, you know, he says he's a businessman. Well, is that a qualification? What do you mean by business? How do you conduct your business? And then, as I read to you from my blog today, or actually blog yesterday and YouTube today, same thing, I said, are you a prisoner to a thin skin, or can you give a proactive definition of freedom that rises higher? So you see, on the one hand, I was looking at economic knowledge, since he says he's a businessman. On the other hand, since he says he's a Presbyterian, I'm asking questions about, well, what is your biblical reference point? Why the thin skin? How could any Christian, whatever the political rationale be, how can he say some of the things that he says when he attacks other people? And the multiple dishonesties. And see, he has no moral compass that I can discern in that regard. I don't know how much you and your listening audience would agree with that, but that's my perspective.
Oh, I've blasted it day and night. What concerns me is first the nationalism that gets behind him in such a rabid way that could easily turn against whole groups of people, be it Mexicans, be it Muslims, you know, ethnicities or religious groups. And then I quoted in a recent article a famous saying by a boxing promoter, Bob Arum. He's in his 80s now. When he was challenged on the veracity of one of his statements, he said, "Yesterday I was lying. Today I'm telling the truth." So I said Donald Trump could get up and say, everything I've told you so far is a lie, and his followers would go, that's our man. He always tells it like it is. That's why we believe him. It's almost a cognitive dissonance. It gets to the point where you literally say, what could he say or do that would turn you away? So I've been very outspoken. It's one thing if someone says, I believe God's raising him up in his sovereign purposes. I don't like him. I don't agree with him, but that's why I support. I can't argue with that, but I have an issue with it. If it's a non-Christian who's part of the abrasive reality TV show, nasty environment, and you know, step over bodies that you've crushed just to get where you're going, I don't like it, but I understand the world you went. I just don't understand professing followers of Jesus. And then the moment I raise these issues and I say I see no clear moral compass, I see no clear moral conservative base, I literally have no idea who he would appoint to Supreme Court justices if elected, and no idea which way he would go next, they say, well, we're not electing a pastor. And it's that, it's just like, we're going to vote for him no matter what, because he can make America great again. It's scary, frankly.
So what is great when you come down to something like this? The nationalism issue you raise is really important. Look at the political skill by which Vladimir Putin basically put down Trump. He praised his vanity, and now Trump says, oh, I can work with the guy. And what is Putin doing? He is a nationalist trying to reclaim the Soviet greatness, and he is willing to spill blood enormously in the process. And so if Trump is driven by a nationalism and an ego as well, where are the boundaries? And I think that's an honest question. So my perspective is this, that our nation is so far adrift from its biblical moorings and is entering into a time of extraordinary confusion, that's exactly what this campaign season is. And I think here we are in mid-February. I don't think we've but begun to uncork the chaos that is in front of us between now and September. From ways we can imagine, ways we cannot imagine. And so, in the midst of all this, I come back to my desire to be proactive. So, you had me give some diagnoses of various candidates. You had me give a diagnosis of Trump, and I'm willing to do that, but I can only do it if I have a prior proactive foundation from which to judge by. And that's why I do all my work in Genesis 1 and 2, my TEI International Leadership School, everything I do. And like Jesus in the face of his enemies, I'm always looking to make sure that the other person is fully listened to. But if they don't want to be listened to, then Jesus is free to call a spade a spade. I just want to give my best energies first to lay out the gospel on its own terms. And in a nutshell, it's that which encourages trust versus distrust. My advisor at Harvard, who chaired three of the university's ethics departments, one time said to the first class I went to, Philosophy 101 course. He said to a large audience, he said, what is the most essential ingredient to a healthy society? And no one could answer the question. And I certainly wasn't going to volunteer my ignorance at the time. And he leaned over the podium and said, trust. And everyone knew what he said was true. Without trust, you have nothing. Money is an exchange of trust. Where is trust? Where does it start? He then said. He said, at the mother's breast, with the husband being faithful to her. So if we want economics, which is the family unit on outward, if we want trust, if we want a healthy politics, it all comes back down to the issues that really motivate us at a foundational level. And that is faithfulness between man and woman in lifetime marriage and the complete humanity of the unborn. And so unless we start there, everything else falls apart.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, and I appreciate you being proactive and bringing us back to Genesis. With that, we are out of time. So let's make it the first official time in our memory. Thanks for gracing our listeners this hour. Again, the website for Theological Educational Institute with International at the end, TEII.org. John, great talking to you. God bless you, and may the kingdom of God come in power to America.
Amen, Michael. Be blessed.
All right. Thank you. All right, friends, my bottom line today, we need God. America needs God. There's not a political solution. We need divine intervention. Some fascinating observations about the Constitution, the death of Justice Scalia, with my guest Joshua Charles, and your calls right here.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Can I tell you exactly what I am not an expert in? Well, I'd take the next 30 years listing the things I'm not an expert in, including a million things I don't even know exist that I'm therefore not an expert in. But one of the things that I'm not an expert in that is important is the Constitution. I know basic things about our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and where contemporary issues intersect with constitutional issues. I've stayed on top of that and Supreme Court decisions and do they have constitutional basis or not. But I am under no way, shape, size, or form, in no way, shape, size, or form, any type of constitutional expert. To suggest that is laughable. And I've never suggested it, nor have any of you listening called wanting to parse a line in the Constitution with me in about an obscure point. However, the more we understand about the Constitution, especially in this election season, the better. In particular, with the death of Justice Scalia, who was a great constitutional jurist, and who was a man who emphasized, he was what's called an originalist, saying that the Constitution was written with a specific intent by its framers, and it is not a living, breathing document that changes with each generation. You can amend it, but the amendment must still be in the spirit of what was originally written because it was written with certain parameters. I'm going to speak with a guest, Joshua Charles. He is an author. He's a researcher. And he wrote a terrific article on the stream. Go to stream.org to read it, stream.org, about Justice Scalia, about the Constitution, about some of the things that are at stake right now. So by all means, check the article out. And then I'm going to get a few minutes with Joshua today. I like the article so much. I said, come on the air. Let's talk about it. I think you'll find it really, really enlightening. It's got nothing to do with the political race in terms of endorsing a candidate or not. It has to do with some historical principles that are of tremendous importance for the future of the nation that I think will be eye-opening for you. All right? Also, do you live in Charlotte, North Carolina? Do you work in Charlotte? Do you go into Charlotte from time to time for entertainment, a restaurant, anything like that, shopping? Please, I'm asking you, as your listener-supported voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution, please go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Excuse me. Don't go there right now. Have it. Sorry. Go to don'tdoitcharlotte.com, D-O-N-T. There's no apostrophe. Don'tdoitcharlotte.com. Go there. Friends, the city council is pushing legislation with the backing of gay activist organizations, pushing on the city of Charlotte something that is destructive and unnecessary, that will not only strike at the liberties of Christians throughout the city, but will impose things. Well, you know what to do? Here you have a man who identifies as a woman, a biological male, walks into the gym where you work out in Charlotte, and he goes into the ladies' locker room where the ladies are changing. And you said, what's he doing in here? The owner would not have the right to say, sorry, sir, you can't go in there. Well, I identify as a woman. I'm legally a woman. Sir, you're a biological male, and it's going to make the ladies uncomfortable. If you say you can't go in there, you could be fined. You could even lose your business. Oh, how about the bathroom at the restaurant? Yeah, and you send your 8-year-old daughter. Yeah, go, honey, right there. I can see you go into the bathroom there. There's a man in the bathroom wearing a dress. Yeah, and that's perfectly legal. This is absurd. You're taking the struggles of a few individuals and now imposing something on everyone. It's madness, friends. It's societal madness. Sign the petition and join us for the rally Monday at 5 in front of the City Council building. Monday at 5. Be there.
Send it, Lord. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire. 866-348-7884. In a moment, I want to speak with Joshua Charles about a fascinating article he's got on the stream. So go to stream.org. It's called The Founders Were Right, and So Was Justice Scalia. I'll introduce Joshua to you in a moment. He's been on The Line of Fire with me previously. But before I speak to Joshua, if you are one of the students at Metrolina Christian Academy, I promised a shout-out today as you got in your cars to drive away. If you were there with me this morning, it was great being with you. I appreciate your heart for worship. I appreciate your heart for the Word, your respectfulness, your listening to me with an open ear as I shared my testimony and called you to follow God wholeheartedly. So if you haven't connected with me yet on Facebook, remember to do it. I got a little video from the chapel service up there that it's Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K, D.R. Brown on Facebook. But a shout-out to Metrolina Christian Academy. Okay. Joshua is the co-author with Glenn Beck of the number one New York Times best-selling book, The Original Argument, and his book, Liberty's Secrets, The Lost Wisdoms of America's Founders, with a foreword by Dennis Prager, was an Amazon bestseller, a book that I spoke well of as well and learned so much from. I could say a lot more about Joshua. Let's bring him right on the air. Hey, Joshua, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dr. Brown. It's always a great honor and joy to be with you.
All right, now, do we just have time for one segment, or are you going to have a couple minutes more? I know you're on a tight schedule now.
So let's do what we need to do.
All right, so first, tell me about this article. What did you mean that the framers were right, the founders were right, and so was Justice Scalia? Right about what?
Sure. Well, essentially about constitutional interpretation. Justice Scalia, ascribed to a view of constitutional interpretation, known by various names, originalism, textualism, et cetera. There's actually, originalism. I mean, there's actually in the scholarly world, there's apparently debates over these various nuances, but essentially it's anchored in the idea that the meaning of the Constitution is not completely black and white all the time. That's not his contention, but that the meaning of the words used need to be grounded in the sense of those who ratified it. So, and that would include not just the Constitution that the founders put together in 1789 or 1787, we ratified in 1789, but also subsequent amendments. So, for example, in the recent gay marriage case, the Obergefell case, they were basing their ruling supposedly on the 14th Amendment. And one of the things that Justice Scalia said in his amazing dissent is essentially, if the people who ratified the 14th Amendment could have possibly have dreamed that the 14th Amendment would be used to justify such, I would argue, a miscarriage of constitutional jurisprudence, they'd be rolling in their graves. And so the same applies to the founders. And I say the founders are right because they offered many, many warnings about this. They provided in the Constitution what's called the amendment process, which is contained in Article 5. And essentially the idea of the amendment process was the founders recognized, I even provided a quote from Washington in there, he says, I don't presume that we're going to be any wiser or more virtuous or anything
right.
than future generations. Right. So we've got to put, a provision in the Constitution that allows, the American people to update it, to get it, aligned with the times, so to speak, if it needs to. And so they put that in because they knew they weren't perfect, and they knew that the Constitution wasn't perfect and it could be improved, as amazing a document as it was. And so, but they said, because there is this process, that's how you have to change it. You don't change the Constitution by just, playing monkey business with the words and trying to redefine them. Again, and Scalia's, the contention of an originalist, textualist, whatever variant of those two words you want to use, is not that the Constitution is always super clear on every single issue. That's not the contention. But the contention is that if we're going to make good law, we have to be, law is all about not clear-cut rules, but stability. That's one of the main characteristics of the law. And so if you're not anchored to the meaning of the text, you're not going to come up with good law, pure and simple. And Madison referred to this, Washington referred to it, Adams referred to it, Jefferson referred to it. And very eerily, actually, Jefferson actually said, even in his own time, this was toward the end of his life, so 1810s, 1820s, that the two clauses that some in the judiciary were using to expand federal power in an unjustifiable way were, ding, 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 the Commerce Clause and the General Welfare Clause, which is exactly the two clauses that have so often been used to expand federal power. Justice Scalia himself has even pointed that out. So,
explain how those clauses are being used, because many of our listeners will not be familiar with that until you flesh it out
for
us.
Sure. Well, the Commerce Clause is essentially, it's in Article 1, Section 8. That's the part of the Constitution that contains the, maybe your listeners might be familiar with the term, enumerated powers. Essentially, I include this at the beginning of the article. Madison called our government a chartered government. And essentially what that means is this, is the people tell the government what its powers are, not the opposite. And the government has whatever the people delegate to it, period. That's it. And they can't go beyond that. And so that the Constitution is, in that sense, a charter. You know, if anybody starts a company or a charter school, you know, those organizations, that corporation is bound by its charter. That charter school is bound by its charter. In the same way, the federal government is supposed, and the states, because the Constitution also mentions the states on various issues. But all the parties involved, they are bound by that document, that charter. And Madison was just reflecting, this was in an editorial he wrote in 1792, so just after the beginning of the Washington administration, on how amazing of an accomplishment this was that, you know, he said in Europe, charters of liberty have been granted by power, meaning those in power told the people, here are your liberties, this is what they are, and we get to decide. But America, he said, has set the example of charters of power granted by liberty. So a free people saying to the government, these are your powers, and you can't go beyond that. So the exact opposite. And so essentially, if the Constitution can mean whatever nine judges on the Supreme Court says it means, we've essentially reinverted the formula and gone back to what has historically been the norm, which is a small, powerful group of people or a single dictatorial type person, a pharaoh or a king or whatever, is telling the people, you know, is drawing up a charter of liberties from a source of power for his people, rather than the people saying, no, here's a charter of your powers. We are already a free people. And so the more and more we get toward that Supreme Court-centric view of the Constitution, where they get to say whatever it is, you know, we're inverting the very essence of the American experiment. Now, that's not to say that the Supreme Court, obviously, it does play a role, and obviously it does set precedent. So I'm not you know, saying Marbury versus Madison, you know, the famous case in the early 1800s. I'm not saying that that's still not good law. But the Supreme Court does have the power to say that certain things are unconstitutional. Whether the branches are totally bound, that's still another discussion. Jefferson didn't seem to think they were. He thought each branch was entitled to its own interpretation of the Constitution. That might be a bit chaotic for my taste, personally. But that's another topic. But I do assert that, as Justice Scalia did, that the text has a meaning. And that meaning isn't always clear-cut, but it does have an objective meaning. So when the 14th Amendment says, you know, every person is entitled, you know, they can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, you know, that's not a carte blanche attempt by the people who ratified it to allow the Supreme Court to make up a whole bunch of other rights, which they have through the erroneous jurisprudence of substantive due process. Justice Scalia talked about that a lot. So, and even in the Federalist Papers, Hamilton said, you know, the biggest government guy of them all back then, he said the judiciary was by far the least powerful branch. It was armed with neither force nor will, but merely judgment. Whereas today, as Justice Scalia took great pains to point out, it seems like it's more controlled by force and will.
All right. We've just got a minute before the break. In the article, you talk about something very extraordinary in America, basically a nation being founded on a document. Can you unpack that just in brief for us?
Yeah, well, essentially just the chartered idea that that the people tell the government what its powers are rather than the opposite. You know, there had been other big documents, for instance, in English constitutional history, Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights from 1689. Those could be repealed by Parliament on a whim. If they wouldn't do that because it would be horrible for them, and they'd probably all get voted out. But Parliament still still retains the prerogative to repeal both of those at any point. Whereas a constitution, you know, the form of government itself set up by a written document, that contains every structure of the government, including, as Justice Scalia often pointed out, the Supreme Court itself.
All right. I've got a couple more questions, if we can grab maybe five more minutes on the other side of the break.
Sure.
And one of them is this. Did the founding fathers ever envision the courts doing what they're doing today? I don't mean redefining marriage. Of course they never countenanced that. But having the power that they have. When Justice Scalia talks about 9 unelected officials controlling everything, he's one of them, but he doesn't think that's what the founders intended. We'll talk with Joshua Charles on the other side of the break.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Joshua Charles, his article on the stream, The Founders Were Right, and So Was Justice Scalia. I think you'll profit by reading that. Some great quotes that were eye-opening for me as I read them. Just I haven't focused on some of these issues in depth as he has. His new book, Liberty's Secrets. You want to find out what the founders said about lots of different key issues? They're in the book, by topic, laid out with actual quotes and sources. Joshua, the balance of powers. Did the founders envision the Supreme Court having the raw power that the court has had for years now to influence the direction of America?
No, they didn't. I mean, that's just the very obvious answer. And among the other quotes in the article that I include are some from Jefferson. He was horrified. I mean, this is in the 1820s. Even back then, he was horrified by what the courts were doing. Jefferson was, what we might call a strict constructionist when it comes to the Constitution. To a certain extent, this has been an argument from the beginning of our country's history, not so much with the Supreme Court, but with how the Constitution should be interpreted. You know, we had this debate with the National Bank that Alexander Hamilton was trying to put forward. And so to a certain extent, again, you know, Justice Scalia and any of his philosophy would not claim that these questions are always clear or that the answer is always obvious. What they would claim is that the court is bound by the Constitution. It doesn't stand above the Constitution. And it is, you know, there was a great line in Justice Scalia's Obergefell dissent, which, I mean, man, I read that dissent and it's just, it's eerie. It's ominous reading it.
It is.
But he
it
said,
is.
You know, it, you know, our one of the fundamental credos of our revolution, and I love that phrase, our revolution, because I think we think it was so long ago, but in the grand scheme of things, it really wasn't. And we should probably go back to remembering what it was all about, but he said in our revolution, and one of the credos was no taxation without representation. And he changed it a bit. He said, that would certainly include no social transformation without representation. The judges on the Supreme Court aren't elected. They aren't directly accountable to the people. And that's fine. The founders intended them to not be elected. They wanted the Supreme Court to be as immune as possible from political pressures. And so that's fine. But they certainly didn't want it to have as much power as it does. You know, I hate the fact that as, obviously I am someone with more conservative values, but as someone who, even before being a conservative, I just love the founders and I love history, and I respect so much what they gave us. I'm disgusted by the fact that we even have to discuss Supreme Court politics to the founding fathers. That'd be a horrendous and ill-advised oxymoron. And so, but unfortunately, that's the reality we're in. And I think one of the things the founders are worried about is if Washington made this quite clear. He said, you know, sometimes you might be able to make a word in the Constitution mean whatever you want it to be, essentially is what he's saying. And, you know, it may even provide a good outcome in the short term. But in the long term, that's always the way that free governments are destroyed. That's what he said. It's right in his farewell address. I include the quote. In the article. Of course, he says it in a much more flowery 18th century English way, but it's nonetheless there. And again, as evidence in the Federalist Papers, the Supreme Court had judgment, the power of judgment, but not force or will. In other words, the idea that the court could just say what the Constitution was for everybody, and that was it, done, said for, it was ridiculous. And even when you account for it within the grander context of the Constitution has all these checks and balances between Congress, the President, the court, but not even that, between the states, between the federal government, between the people, between the many, between the few, between the one, all these various interplaying forces. But then this idea that the Supreme Court gets to decide what all this means for everybody, it makes no sense. And historically, it's insane. It's not supportable historically. And, you know, if somebody says, well, the founders were wrong, fine. I respect them for being honest and open about that, because that's what they truly believe. But to try to pawn this off as, the court needs to evolve with the times. No, we can evolve with the times. We can pass an amendment. That's the process there. The founders didn't think they were God. We don't either, but there is an amendment process. Why would there be an amendment? I mean, if the living constitution ideology was correct, why would our ancestors, I didn't get to include this in the column because I was already over my word limit, but, you know, why would we have to pass an amendment to ban slavery? Why would we have to pass an amendment to give women the right to vote? Aren't these all, you know, things that the Supreme Court could just tell us in its loose jurisprudence these days, according to the living constitution advocates? You know, our forebears, if the living constitution ideology is correct, were certainly quite confused because they felt that on something as blatantly obvious both back then and today as slavery required a constitutional amendment, and they were correct. And so if we want to have things, and Scalia, he was, you know, on a purely legal level, he was fine. If a state wanted to allow gay marriage, let them. That's their prerogative. But that's not for the court to decide. So anyway, I'm kind of blabbering at this point, but
that's right. It's good blabber.
Body of the founders. Yeah.
Good and useful blabber. All right. One minute again.
Sure.
Is there anything constitutionally about whether the president should try to appoint a justice now, where the Congress should go along with it or resist it? Is that just a purely political battle with the Constitution?
Yeah. No, I'm going to be writing a column about this as well, so a preview here. But no, the Congress is not required to approve his choices, of course. Now, I would say I think the Constitution, there's an implied duty for Congress to at least accept or deny the nominee. So I do think Congress should certainly resist the president on this. This is exactly why we have a division of powers. If the Congress feels that the president will appoint justices that will not be faithful to the Constitution, they have a constitutional right and a duty to block him. And the same would go for the Democratic Party if they were in power right now. But the fact is, our founders gave that power, the power of appointing Supreme Court justices, to two organs of government. And actually, if you read the Federalist Papers, for example, the founders thought, as James Madison says in Federalist 62, that it was the Senate that was the anchor of the government. You know, they envisioned the Senate being the chamber of the elder statesmen. That's why the terms are longer, and the age precipice, you know, to be a senator, the requirement is higher than for being in the House. And so that's what Madison literally calls it, that the anchor of the government. And so if the Senate is not satisfied that the president is sending nominees who will support and defend the Constitution, as all judges are required to swear an oath by, no, stop them. They don't have to. There's nothing that requires them. But I do think they should have an up or down vote. I don't think the Constitution, at least impliedly, I don't think it would sanction, you know, filibustering and parliamentary tactics to block it. I think there should be an up or down vote.
All right. Hey, I got to jump in. We're out of time, but thank you for weighing in.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown.
And again, the book, Liberty's Secrets, about the Founding Fathers. Joshua Charles, thanks for joining us, man. Much appreciated. All right, friends, give me a call. We're going to weigh in. We've got a half hour to go. Anything you want to talk about relative to this broadcast, phone lines are open. I got some calls I want to get to. 866-348-7884.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I have spent an hour and a half talking with some very learned, fascinating guests, John Rankin and Joshua Charles. You can catch up with the show later by going to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, talking about Supreme Court, Constitution, Kingdom of God, politics. I think you'll find the interviews fascinating and in-depth. But what I want to focus on now is your calls. Anything that you want to weigh in on or ask me about, be it moral, cultural, political, or even biblical, I'm going to take your calls, 866-348-7884. And I'm going to start in Atlanta with Ash, but stay right there, Ash. I'm going to get to you momentarily. That reminds me to announce to all of you listening in Greater Atlanta, I am scheduled to be speaking tomorrow night for Bishop Dale Brunner at Word of Faith. That is a large congregation, a mega church in Greater Atlanta. I'll be speaking on revival tomorrow night at 7:30 at their midweek service. To find out more, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, right where it says contact, click on itinerary. Also, as I'm speaking to many of you in Charlotte, North Carolina, you live in or near Charlotte, you work in or near Charlotte, you go in and out of Charlotte periodically or regularly, please give me your best ear. Please give me your best ear. There is a push with radical gay activists behind it, with large budgets to try to push these things through, a push to get the city council, with the support of Mayor Roberts, to pass a radical bill. It is allegedly a bill against gay and lesbian and transgender discrimination. And everyone should be treated fairly and equally under the law, every human being. Okay, everyone should be treated with justice and fairness, obviously. As a Christian, of course, I uphold that. At the same time, if you're going to pass a bill that now puts Christians in a position where they can be discriminated against, for example, you're a photographer, and two gay men come in and say, hey, we hear you do great photo shoots, we'd like you to shoot our wedding, you say, I'm so sorry, but we're a Christian operation, and I don't do that. I just refused. Someone else wanted me to do another shoot that was violated my convictions, so no, I can't do that. You could lose your business. You could be fined. You could potentially go to jail if you wouldn't pay a fine. But what about religious liberties? No, they get trumped. They get trumped. That could be law in Charlotte. I'm not exaggerating. Okay, this has happened in other parts of the country to quite a few people already. Be forewarned. But it gets worse. I spoke this morning at a chapel for Metrolina Christian Academy. If any of you are listening there, shout out. You're a great group to talk to this morning. And when I walked through the school buildings, I went into the wrong office. They sent me down. So I had to walk through an elementary school wing and then to get over to where the chapel was going to be for middle school and high school students. So in any case, I just had to stop in the restroom first. And they said, there's a restroom right over there. So I went in. And then as I was coming out, I noticed these little boys coming in. That's when I realized it was the elementary school wing. And I'm thinking, hang on. You're in a situation now where if this bill passes in Charlotte, this is what's being pushed. We call it the bathroom bill, rightly so. Every public facility, so let's say a restaurant, let's say a gym, every bathroom and locker room, someone can go there based on their perception of who they are. So a man dressed as a man, a biological male dressed as a woman, either way, who believes that he's a woman, can use the ladies' restroom and the ladies' locker room, and there's nothing you can do about it. And when you send your little boy into the restroom, just down here, okay, we can see you, just go right there. Mommy and daddy, you're watching, you know, it's you got your 8-year-old boy and his 10-year-old brother, and okay, you're in the restaurant here, we can see the, go right over there. And they come back in a state of shock. There's a lady in there, and she says she's a man. That's ridiculous. That is a horrific infringement on the rights of others. Go to Don't Do It Charlotte, D-O-N-T, don'tdoitcharlotte.com. Sign the petition and join me at the Charlotte Mecklenburg Government Building, 5 o'clock Monday for a rally. 5 o'clock.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. If you missed it, 5 o'clock, please, everyone that can be there, Greater Charlotte, the more people we have, the louder message we send to the state, because the state could overturn the wrong things that Charlotte wants to do, okay? So your presence, one person, two, five, 10, if it's 100, if it's 500, if it's 1,000, if it's 2,000, I don't know how many people will be there, but your presence literally makes a difference. And there may be others there that differ with you. You'll be able to talk with them and interact and maybe share the gospel. And then there's the city council meeting, which is going to be very important following. Are their minds already made up? Could be. Seems that way. But we're going to get a message out. We're going to hold them accountable, not in a mean-spirited, angry way, but in a biblically right way. We're going to hold them accountable. And then the rally that we have and your presence there will send a message to the state. You say, I'm frustrated. You can do something. So if you have to sacrifice to do it, leave work early, come there with your family, do what you can. Young people, older people, get out. 5 o'clock Monday. And young people, show the state that you care about these issues. Show the state that this is not just a grandparents' issue and not just a parents' issue. This is an issue for everyone. 5 o'clock Monday. That's the 22nd. I'll be speaking there. Then I've got to go straight to the airport, but I was able to switch a flight, move it to later to do it. All right? I know you're listening around the country, but please be praying for Charlotte. All right? We want to make a difference here. By God's grace, I've been able to make a difference in other nations. Christians around the country have made a difference in different states. Let's make a difference right here where many of us live and work, in front of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg government building right in the heart of Uptown Charlotte, Monday the 22nd at 5. All right, we go to Atlanta. Ash, thank you for holding. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, how you doing? I had a question about how the church's role in racial reconciliation in our country, and from a biblical perspective, passages that assert or give a great championing cause for facilitating. The church being a significant player in facilitating racial reconciliation within our country. Because I oftentimes find, like, the New Testament really gives a good aggressive message towards unity of all tribes, tongues, and nations. But oftentimes in the dynamic of our country, equality is lifted up almost sometimes above unity. So I'm just trying to figure out some passages that would help gather my thoughts around that area.
Yeah, I appreciate you thinking about these issues in a clear-headed way and not just looking at surface things, but digging deeper. Okay, number one, of all institutions, groups, organizations, bodies within America, the church must lead the way. If we can't lead the way here, how can the rest of the world get it right? Because there is an essential unity we enjoy in Jesus as those whose sins were forgiven and who are part of the family of God and who'll be together forever. There's an essential unity we enjoy that transcends the unity that the rest of society and all of its divisions enjoys. Now, I understand the old quote that the church is the most segregated place in America on Sunday mornings. I understand that. But in many ways, there's been a lot that churches have done across denomination, across racial and ethnic lines to come together and deal with racial injustice and lack of reconciliation. So we start with the passages that emphasize our oneness in Jesus, that there's neither male nor female, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither Jew nor Greek. In that respect, there's neither black nor white, that who we are is who we are on the inside. Dr. Ben Carson had pointed out that when you do brain surgery, once you cut the person open, there's no black or white. You're just dealing with a human being with a brain. So we want to start there with those principles. We want to go back to the Acts 17 principle that we're all of one blood and one race. And then we also want to celebrate diversity. We want to recognize that God has not made everyone and everything within the body identical. In fact, he's made us very, very different in many different ways. So this is something we celebrate. We don't downplay it. We celebrate it, that we each have something unique to bring. So I would use the body imagery from 1 Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, many different parts of the body, yet one functioning body, to say that's how it is with race and color and ethnicity. I love to worship in churches of different ethnic backgrounds. I remember in Germany one time where I preached three services on a Sunday for three different congregations that met in one building. So there was a German congregation, I think a Brazilian congregation, and a Nigerian congregation, and the three services were as different as you could imagine, and yet one spirit in Jesus. So we number one, recognize neither male nor female, neither black nor white in Jesus. We're all of one race and people. Then we recognize that there's diversity, and that's great. Ethnic diversity, diversity in style, approach, emphasis, that's what makes the body beautiful. And then thirdly, we look at principles of justice. And we here's where we must have a conversation. I wrestled with this for months and months, listening carefully to my callers when we went through issues, say, with the death of Trayvon Martin at the hands of George Zimmerman. What can we learn from that? And what are the different perspectives on that? And then with the death of my namesake, Michael Brown, at the hands of a police officer. And what could we learn from that? And I listened carefully, interacted, and I said, my take is that we each have blind spots. Every group, every individual, we have blind spots. And I said, it seems that the blind spot of white Americans, many white Americans, is that when racism is there, we don't see it. But then the blind spot of many black Americans is that when racism isn't there, they do see it. So what does that mean? It means we have to sit down and have hard conversations. We have to sit down and let's say I'm a white man, you're a black man. I say, tell me about how the world looks from your perspective. Tell me how America looks from your perspective. Tell me about your upbringing. Tell me about how you were treated in school. Tell me what you face in the job. Tell me your reaction to an Al Sharpton or a Jesse Jackson. Tell me your reaction to these different cases. What do you think about Black Lives Matter? And then you, the same with me. We talk the things through, and many times we don't understand each other. I've never been racially profiled. You know, I've never been stopped just because I looked a particular way. I mean, before I was a believer in my drug days. I mean, that had nothing to do with racial profiling, but that was just I was giving it away by the way I looked. But there are perspectives that we each have. And then you know, I could say, hey, it seems like the government's put a lot of black Americans in this entitlement mentality and welfare, et cetera, and it's hurt people or the high levels of abortion in black America. How can that be and yet support a Democratic candidate? And so we put on the table, we may offend each other, but in love, we're going to hear each other out. In other words, we're not going to avoid issues. And then we take it to the Lord and say, God, give us a heart of love for each other and help us work these things through. But we must have the honest conversations. Otherwise, we'll never know what our neighbor's world really looks like and feels like. So that's scriptural principles and the general approach that I've been trying to use on the radio over these years. I hope that gives you some food for thought.
It does. Do you know of any books from any good from an evangelical standpoint that would give a lot of clarity to this issue and just to dive in and research a little more?
Yeah, there's a book by my friend Craig Keener that he co-authored. Let me just find this. You know, I forget the name of it, but I'm going to look it up right as we're talking now. My friend Craig Keener, one of the world's top New Testament scholars, he co-authored a book with a black author. Craig spent a lot of time worshiping, serving in black churches over the year, and Craig himself is white, and he's married to an African woman. Let me just find this. The problem is Craig. Here we go. It's called, Defending Black Faith, Craig Keener and Glenn Usry, Usry. They wrote a couple of books, A Black Man's Religion, and then Defending Black Faith, Answers to Tough Questions About African-American Christianity. Here you'll have a dialogue. It may not be the best book that directly addresses this, but because you have a black author and a white author, both committed Christians, I think you'll find a lot of useful information in there and good stuff to chew on, okay? So if you just look up Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R, and Glenn Usry, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, U-S-R-Y, I think it's a very useful starting point, all right?
Great, great. Thank you so much.
God bless you. Thank you, sir. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, I will get to your phone calls immediately on the other side of the break, all right? I've got just a few seconds. I don't want to rush your phone call. Hey, we told you this would be coming, but got a man in the ladies' bathroom, locker room, can't kick him out in Seattle. Why? Well, gender discrimination. This is madness. Don't let it happen in Charlotte. Go to Don't Do It Charlotte, D-O-N-T, Do It Charlotte. So there's no apostrophe. Don'tDoItCharlotte.com and join me Monday, 5 o'clock. Get there. If you have to get there a few minutes late, show up. Your presence makes a difference. It'll send a message to the state. 5 o'clock in front of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Government Building in Uptown Charlotte. Monday, 5 o'clock Monday.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Huntersville, North Carolina. Ryan, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. How are you, brother?
Doing well, thanks.
I just had a question on, a little off topic, but the resurrection of Daniel 12. Just so you know where I'm coming from, I hold to the preterist view of prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel 12:2, I'm sure you would agree, seems to be speaking of a resurrection.
Yeah, it's clearly a future resurrection that is not yet. Yeah, a future resurrection at the end of the age in harmony with other verses that we're still looking forward to when multitudes will rise, some to eternal life and some to eternal
right.
shame and mm-hmm. condemnation.
Correct.
Yep.
Right. And then verse 7 says, I'm sure you're familiar with the verse, it will be for time, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things will be completed. Now, you know, I believe this is AD 70, but I know you don't. So my question is...
Yeah, Daniel 12:2, of course, has not happened under any exegetical sense. And notice that you have Daniel 12:1-3, stop, and now... Daniel chapter 12, verse 4, actually verses 4 and 5, now start with something else. So Daniel 12:2, in any case, is not connected to Daniel 12:7. So even if you say that Daniel 12:7 referred to the times of Antiochus Epiphanes and his war against the Jewish people and then their supernatural victory, or if you say it's something in AD 70 or even any other time, it doesn't matter. It's unrelated to Daniel 12:2.
So the resurrection of Daniel 12:2, and then when Daniel asks, when will these things be? And he says, when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, you think that's two different events?
Well, you've got a whole book of Daniel up to then. You've got many, many other prophecies before that, okay? But in any case, here's what we do know. There's no direct connection between Daniel 12:7 and Daniel 12:2. He could be referring to 10 other prophecies that have been spoken in the book prior to that. What we do know is this. You go from the clear to the unclear. Jesus said the day will come when people, the dead, will rise. They will get out of their graves, not spiritually, but physically. All right? They will be physically resurrected, and some will go into eternal condemnation, some into eternal life. Jesus said it very plainly in John 5. Many other passages, Paul explicitly talks about a physical resurrection from the dead. In 1 Corinthians 15, he goes into details as to exactly what it's going to be. And numerous passages point to that. The book of Isaiah also points to this physical resurrection. This has not happened. This has not happened that all who have previously died have been physically resurrected and been judged either as saved or lost by the cross. That has not happened. Daniel 12:2 is speaking about that. Those who sleep in the dust shall awake. Those sleeping in the dust have not yet awakened. There are hundreds of millions of people in graves, billions around the world. They have not yet awakened. So we go from, that's clear. There's no exegetical historical argument against that.
So my question would be then, does that necessitate a future shattering of the power of the holy people? And what would that power be, and who would that people be, since the church is God's holy people?
Well, the holy people have always been God's elect. The ecclesia is the same word in Greek for the elect in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And God gave promises to Old Testament saints as well that he would deliver them and be with them. But why do you keep in here? So do you accept, just so I can make sure I'm talking with someone who's taking the word seriously, do you accept that the physical resurrection from the dead spoken of by Jesus and Paul and Isaiah and Daniel, where everyone who's previously died will be physically resurrected, that that has not yet happened?
Well, I deny that these verses are talking about physical bodies coming out.
All right, then we can't have a discussion then. In other words, this is a complete waste of everyone's time, including yours. Why? Because if you're now going to get into an obscure prophetic question in the book of Daniel, and a verse that could be interpreted numerous different ways in Hebrew, all right, and that could well refer to something future, and you're going to deny the plain sense of passage after passage passage.
What is that future event then?
No. I'm not going to discuss that. In other words, you don't accept the authority of Scripture in these areas. So I cannot answer a secondary question about a verse when you don't accept the plain sense of Scripture about a physical resurrection that all the church leaders universally held to, and the Judaism out of which Jesus came from universally held to based on these verses, all those that understood there was a future resurrection. So it's a fruitless conversation. It's just a silly argument. It's a completely silly argument. If you say there's no such thing as sun, moon, and stars, but I'd like to discuss with you this question about the sun in the year 4000.
To get into the nature a little bit, Paul says the first is the physical, then the spiritual. What is sown is raised up a spiritual.
There will be a spirit body. There will be a literal resurrection, just as Jesus was literally raised from the dead. I see you're not willing to accept the testimony of Scripture and the testimony that has been universally held to for centuries that understood a future resurrection. So in that sense, it's just a silly argument, and it's not fair to listeners. It's not fair to anyone. Okay, to be totally candid with you. So here's what we know. The language is explicit. There will be a future resurrection where people will bodily get out of the grave. Jesus says it explicitly in John 5 and other places. Paul says it explicitly in 1 Thessalonians, the 4th chapter, and in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter. Daniel says it explicitly here in Daniel, the 12th chapter. Isaiah speaks of it explicitly in Isaiah, in the apocalypse of Isaiah, Isaiah 24 to 27. And numerous other New Testament passages point to that as well, and imagery in the book of Revelation as well. So if that's denied, then why am I going to discuss a verse in Daniel that could potentially ever apply to days in about 150 years before the time of Jesus, could potentially have applied to days before the second temple was destroyed, which was the church then, the people of God then, or could potentially refer to the end of the age, where God's people come to the end of themselves, just like 2 Corinthians 1, so that we then lean on the Lord. We come to the end of ourselves. It looks like there's no hope, just like Christians persecuted around the world, and God comes and delivers. But please, sir, go back to Scripture. Preterism is blinding your eyes to what the Word of God says. And when you're willing to do that, and you're not going to tell me that we're now in a new heavens and new earth, and there's no more pain and sorrow and death, then we can have a conversation. So, sorry to be so blunt, but that's the reality. And Stephanie, I don't have time to take your call, but the question about environmental issues, perhaps diet or other things like that, in things that we are taking in that is leading to gender confusion or other issues like that, hormonal issues, that's all possible. I know there's more you have to say. Maybe you can call on Friday and we can discuss this further, but just no time to get to the call. But are there environmental issues that could be contributing to physical, biological problems, confusion? Could well be. Doesn't mean we change the world based on that, but could well be. Hey, gotta run. My bottom line today, if you run from the plain sense of Scripture, you will fall into many ditches along the way.